Well, I told David, you know, just to mention four things, and that would be enough, but he didn't do what I told him to do. But I'm glad to be here in Memphis. Thank you, Larry Peoples, for inviting me. And I'm still trying to figure out, Larry, how it was that we got to know each other. And I'm staying at the Jim Sexton Hilton while I'm in town. And I thank him for getting me here also. But it's a joy to be here in Memphis. I love Memphis. I had John Bramlett to come speak at my FCA at Alabama three or four times. And I'm just really thrilled about sharing with you tonight some of the experiences I've had in life. But Memphis is just a place that I do know this. I have lived in seven states. And for a boy from, you know, small town Alabama, I crowned Memphis as the barbecue center of the United States. And because, you know, everybody, every state I've ever lived in, they had the best, you know. But I tell you, nobody has as many quality barbecue places as this place does. But I want to say that when I was in high school growing up in central Alabama, it was a Tucson mill town, by the way. I got to Clinton. We got to Clinton, the county seat. My daddy, as David says, was a small town country preacher. I came to Christ on the Sawdust Trail at the age of 8 in a tent revival that my daddy led, and I knelt at an altar that he built. So I love that background. I never rebelled from what my daddy preached. We went to six towns on Saturday morning and Saturday afternoon when I was 7, 8 years old with two loudspeakers over the car preaching the gospel. And that's why I'm where I am today. And that's where I get my zeal for evangelism. But when I was growing up, and I always thought, everybody thought I was supposed to be a preacher like my daddy. But I love sports, you know, and I lived just 55 miles from Tuscaloosa. Nobody in our family had ever been to college, so had a great player named Harry Gilmer, and he was the reason I became an Alabama fan. But when I was growing up, I loved to read the sports magazines, and I said, I want to be a sports writer like Grantland Rice. And Grantland Rice wrote for the New York Herald Tribune. He was the best in the 20s, 30s, and 40s. And by the way, he's from Murfreesboro, Tennessee, and he's a Vanderbilt graduate, if you didn't know that. But he was the master with words. And some of you may remember these words. Outlined against the blue-gray October sky, the four horsemen rode again. In dramatic lore, they are known as famine, pestilence, destruction, and death. They're only aliases. Their real names are Stude, Drucker, Miller, Crowley, and Layden. They formed the crest of the South Bend Cyclone, before which another Fighting Army football team was swept over the precipice at the Polo Grounds yesterday afternoon as 55,000 spectators peered down on the bewildering panorama spread on the green plain below. Yesterday, the Cyclone struck again as Notre Dame beat Army 13-7. You don't read sports writing like that today. I love that, and I wanted to be like him because, for one thing, he wore a three-piece suit, and he wore a fedora hat, and he wore wingtip shoes, and I thought that was great. But sports writing is nothing like it used to be because technology has turned into statistics and breakdowns. They're doing an overkill to me on the things that they come up with. It's just like this. You know, today it's almost like if a quarterback wears a size 10 shoe and a 7 1/4 helmet, and he has a waist size of 34, and he's a guy that when he's on the 3-yard line, he's going to score 71.3% of the time. You know, I kind of get fed up with some of those statistics, don't you, Kyle? And great to see Kyle here tonight. I tell you, I used to know Kyle a long time ago. What a great family. But almost 2 weeks ago, I went to the College Football Hall of Fame in Atlanta for the first time. How many of you have been to the College Football Hall of Fame in Atlanta? Well, you must go. But I spent a quick 2 hours there, and the thing I loved the most was the quotes by Newt Rockne of Notre Dame and General Robert Nayland of Tennessee and even Ronald Reagan, and of course Wallace Wade of Alabama and Duke, and Amos Alonzo Stagg at Chicago. And they were talking about what football taught players, young people, the lessons they learn in life from discipline and hard work and teamwork and all of that. And I just loved that. And guess what they had beside John Heisman's name? He's known, you know, for the Heisman Trophy. They named it after him. Coached at Georgia Tech and Auburn and some other schools. But this is what was beside his name. He would sometimes leave practice early so he could attend the opera. The opera. Now, that wouldn't go over too well today. Now, some schools might think their coach does that, but that's when the sport was not a matter of life and death. And, you know, if you don't win this game this week, you're going to be fired. When I was at Alabama, I used to speak at civic meetings during the week of the Alabama-Auburn week. And I would say this. I heard this. Somebody said that the Alabama-Auburn game is not a matter of life and death. It's more serious than that. And you know, when I became sports information director at Alabama, Coach Bryant had just died, and I was hired by Ray Perkins. You know, we get to the Alabama-Auburn game, and I was so tense, I was just shaking, you know, when the game started. And I could hardly stay inside my skin. And I thought, this is ridiculous. And so, you know, I just made a decision that I'm going to enjoy. I'm not going to get uptight and tense and everything. There's nothing I can do that happens down on that field anyway. And so I got where I, everywhere I went, I enjoyed everybody's traditions, their songs, their yells, pageantry, everything. I just got where I enjoyed everything. And it made it a whole lot more, pleasant in having that experience. And I got where I couldn't wait for the kickoff. Alabama-Auburn came along, I was ready to go. But I had to learn that. But, you know, this is a little bit long with the Sextons here. I throw this out, but you know who the highest-paid public employees in our states today, who they are? Yeah, it's the college football or basketball coach. And in 39 states, that is true. Now, in 39 states, the top five, of course, are Nick Saban. This is some of the latest. Now, it could change, you know, week by week. $11 million a year. And Jim Harbaugh, number two at $9 million, and he hadn't even won a conference championship yet. And Kentucky basketball coach, one of your guys, John Calipari, he's at $7 million. Urban Meyer's at $6 million. And Jimbo Fisher is at $5 million. But when Coach Paul Bear Bryant coached at Alabama, his life's top salary was $100,000 for the year. And Coach Nick Saban makes twice that much in 1 week. If you figure it out, he makes twice that much in 1 week, $200,000 a week is what he makes. And it's good work if you can get it. But, the sport in some ways has left its purest form from the old days, but it's still great entertainment, and we can't do without it. Yeah, I spent 28 years in college football, and I still can't believe it. I'm so surprised at what's happened in my life, but 22 were at Alabama, and we had 3 national championships, and I only missed 13 games in 22 years. When I go back for a game, I go back and see who I can see. You know, I can see all my buddies and friends and everything, and then I'll say, all of a sudden, well, we're going to play a football game here today. You know, I've seen a lot of football. But my career did start with 2 great legends, Bobby Bowden and Bear Bryant. I was 18 as a freshman. When Coach Bowden was 30 years old, that's when we first knew each other. And we started at Howard College in 1960. And that's when I was a freshman. And he was in his second year at Howard, which is, of course, today Samford University, the Baptist school down in Birmingham. And you know what our first game was when I was a freshman? We came up and played Memphis Navy. Y'all remember that team? Memphis Navy. And we had a good day that day, and we shut them out. And I'd never heard of Memphis Navy, but we played Memphis Navy. And at 30, Coach Bowden at 30 was the best athlete on campus. He was better than any athlete on campus. He was highly energetic. Players had to hustle to keep up with him. A ferocious handball player. He beat everything on campus in handball. That was with your hands, you know, that's the old way to do it. And he was highly spirited, full of pep, always happy. Nehemiah 8:10 was his verse. It says, "The joy of the Lord is my strength," and that was Bobby Bowden. He was, "Hello, buddy, how you doing?" And he, with those dadgum statements, he charmed everybody, and he made football fun. And, of course, it was fun then because he had a 31-6 record. He won 83% of his games, and he won them by a margin of 28-8 when he was coaching at Howard. 28-8. You know, we never dreamed of what was going to happen to him. Never dreamed that he was going to go on and win more games, really, than anybody else. But things you probably didn't know about, wouldn't know about Coach Bowden, is that his home telephone number was never unlisted. You could always call that number. You could find it in the phone book, and you could call that number, and somebody would answer. And the other day, before the Alabama-Florida State game, I called him the day before. We still stay in touch over the years. And, you know, phone rang, and, "Hello," you know, and he says, "How you doing, boy?" You know, I'm 75, and he called me boy. But that's okay. And, you know, we talked about the game. He loves Billy Graham. He told me when I went with Billy Graham, he's my all-time hero. And that's true with Bobby Bowden. And he told me, we talked about the game a little bit, and next Tuesday after it was the day before the Alabama-Florida State game. And, you know, I thought the game would go either way because they had a great team. And, of course, we got those turnovers and beat them 24-7. But here's the thing. He emailed me. We emailed about Tuesday. And this is what he said in that email. You'll find this interesting. "It's an old coaching philosophy. If you don't win a football game, you don't..." Let me back up. "You don't win a football game. You lose it." And he put "lose it" in capital letters. And those of you who coach and know football well, you know that you feel like you lost the game more than, you know, sometimes you win it. And I thought he'd never mentioned that to me before. When he was coaching at Florida State on Friday nights, you know what he would do? When he had the team together on Friday night after the movie or something, he would give a devotion before he went into the game plan. And it was his desire that every player that ever played for him heard the gospel many times before they left Florida State. It wasn't going to be because he didn't let them know what the gospel is. And then for the past 7 years, he's been going out like an evangelist all over America. He'll be 88 in November. But he goes, and he has to have a private plane, but he'll go. And when he gets there, he'll want to know if there are any unsaved people in the audience here tonight. He hopes they will be, because he's going to give them the gospel along with all of his great football stuff. But that's Bobby Bowden. And when I was sports information director at Alabama, I went to bed on a Friday night thinking that tomorrow we're going to name Coach Bobby Bowden as the football coach. Really. And it was just a done deal. And I got back to my office the next morning, and it was Coach Bill Curry they were going to announce. And we announced him about 1 o'clock that day. It was fast stuff. And he went back to Florida State, and for the next 14 years, he was in the top 5 finishes in 14 straight seasons. Well, guess what we did at Alabama in the next 16 years? We had 6 coaches and 7 athletic directors. I went through all of them. And we did win a national championship with Gene Stallings in 92. And he won 2 national championships down at Florida State. But let me tell you, that was kind of a sad time when he didn't come, but God just had him to be at Florida State. And, you know, he still lives today in the same house when he coached at Florida State. Lives in the same house. He goes out to eat every day. He and his wife go out about 2 o'clock or 3 o'clock in the afternoon when there's not many people out. And he walks about a mile, he walks about an hour and a half every day. And, of course, he does all these speaking engagements. But There's a new film out on Coach Bowden, and it hadn't been on television yet. It's been in theaters, and it's fantastic about his legacy. And let me tell you, in that film, I couldn't believe it, but Coach Lou Holtz said that Bobby Bowden was the greatest football coach of all time. I think I know why he said it, because there's been a lot of great coaches, but he used his faith strong throughout the whole thing. I mean, for the complete package, it was hard to beat Bobby Bowden. And especially with including that strong faith that he maintained. But when I graduated from Howard, I went to Alabama. And you know, it's amazing. Jimbo Fisher, you know where he played his college football? Stanford University. Same place Coach Bowden did. And a lot of people don't know this, but Jimbo Fisher was an assistant coach at Stanford for 5 years. And now, of course, he's at Florida State. It's amazing how those two guys end up from Stanford to Florida State. But I was blessed to go to Alabama in 1964, starting graduate school. And I got a position in sports publicity. There's two men in the office. Charlie Thornton, an Arkansas State grad, was the SID, and he had me. And we were two people, and Namath was a senior. Joe Namath was a senior. But it was Coach Bryant's seventh year, and he was 51 years old. He was the toughest football coach in America, pro or college. And he motivated by fear. He motivated by fear. I mean, there was no nonsense. It was all business. And every boy in Alabama wanted to play for him to prove their manhood. And when I went there, I thought if I could work around Coach Bryant, I could work for anybody. And that was the truth. That was the truth. And I did have two good years there. I covered every practice and every game, 64 and 65, won national championships. And I saw him come down off that tower many times. Boy, that was in the day when you could yank players around. I've seen him get down and show guys how to block. And it was just that way. He was all business. Even in Moore Hall, the athletic department, if he was in California, you acted like he was still down the hall. You just maintain your still, because if he found out something when he got back, it'd be just, he might be out of there. So that's the way it was with Coach Bryant. But for you young folks, I want to tell you who you're here tonight. You're hearing a history lesson. You know, you need to know who Bobby Bowden was and who Bear Bryant was and who Billy Graham was. But Coach Bryant coached at football at 25 years at Alabama, and he won 6 national championships and could have won really easily 3 or 4 others. But I had 2 great memories with Coach Bryant. After every practice, there's a small room by the coach's office, and we had 2 or 3 writers at that time who would gather after practice to get the quotes. A lot of days it's just he and I. And I'm sitting there, and this big old giant of a man puts those big steel boots, the big old boots on that steel desk, and pulls out a Chesterfield cigarette. And he just relaxes, and I don't say a word. I know better than to try to ask a stupid question. So I don't say a word. And I just wait till he gives me the comments and the quotes he wants, and I go back to the office. I just slip out and go back to the office and report to UPI and AP and some of the papers. And there was a great memory of that. And then one day, I always picked up in my 1954 Ford. It was 10 years old at that time. Every day after lunch, I'd pick up the athletic department mail. And I was putting the mail up in the boxes, and we just had a very handful of staff people. And so he comes by, and he asked if this certain magazine had come in. Well, it hadn't come in. That was after the Saturday Evening Post deal. Some of you men remember that. And so here's the deal. He says to me, well, let's go down to the student union, and I need to get a bite to eat, and let's just go by the post office to see if it's come in maybe. Oh, my gosh, it's all I could do to hold myself together, because this guy. And so we walked 2 blocks down by Denny Chimes and by the President's Mansion, and I'm trying to hold myself together as a little kid, 23 years old. And we walk in that student union. He gets a piece of chocolate pie and a piece of chocolate cake and coffee, and I have already eaten in Bryant Hall, and I got me a Coke and tried to have some conversation. And I was so hoping that magazine would be in when we went to check it. And sure enough, it wasn't in. And I went up and told him, well, Coach Bryant, the magazine hadn't come in. And his response was, well, if it's not in, it's not in. We turned, walked. And I'm going to tell you, students were out for class for lunch. And when they saw him coming down, they actually stopped and stared. It was just that way. It was like God had just walked by. That was a memory I'll never forget. He was a master psychologist. He knew how to treat players differently. One of my favorite stories is a boy down South Alabama named Keith Pugh. He caught balls from Stedman Shealy in the late 70s. When he was on his recruiting trip, he and his parents came into Coach Bryant's office on Sunday afternoon, like all the recruits do, when they're ready to go. And he checks them out, see what they're thinking. And his daddy asked this question, Coach Bryant, if I send my boy up here, will he become a truck driver like me? What a challenging question for Coach Bryant. Here's what he said. He said, well, if he comes up here and becomes a truck driver, he'll be the best. What a great answer. But that was Coach Bryant for you. He was brilliant. And let me tell you what that guy is doing today. He is a fine Baptist pastor in Tuscaloosa. You just can't imagine that boys who played rough football with Coach Bryant turn out to be preachers and pastors and evangelists, can you? But they do. And we've had many of them. But Steve Sloan was assistant. You know, Steve's from Cleveland, Tennessee. He was a great, saw this gentleman here tonight. He was a great high school athlete, all-state in three sports. And he was assistant coach for two or three years with Coach Bryant. He was up in the box. So one day in a game, it was getting tense. The other team was moving the ball, and Coach Bryant ordered Steve up there from get Derby in the game, get Derby in the game. And he said, I didn't know in that moment how I could tell Coach Bryant that Derby had graduated 2 years ago. You know, but it actually happened. And Ron Derby, you know, was from Memphis, Tennessee. Some of you may remember that. But Scott Hunter was a great guy. He quarterbacked in the late 60s. And he's funny to talk to. But one day against Tennessee, they were beating us over here in Knoxville. And Coach Bryant told Coach Ken Donahue, our great defensive coordinator, he said, if they score one more time, you're fired. And let me tell you, Scott, and they scored, and he fired Coach Donahue right there on the sideline. And so Scott just went, Coach Bryant just fired Coach Donahue. That's the way Scott is. But in that same game, Scott threw five interceptions. And one of the receivers came to the huddle, and he said, Scott, if you'll throw it to the defensive back, I'll try to intercept it. Well, but you know, of all the quotes, one of my favorite of Coach Bryant was, the same things win that always win. We just have a different set of excuses if we lose. And that's so true. That's the way Coach Bryant was. But as most of you know, he coached his last game in Memphis. That was the 1982 Liberty Bowl. And they played Illinois, and they won 21-15. It was a tight game. And boys wanted to win it so bad, knowing it was his last game. And there were 54,000 there. And today you can go on eBay and get one of those game programs for $100. But for years before his retirement, he said, if I quit, I'll probably croak in a month. And that's exactly what happened. He died in 1 month. He was in the Tuscaloosa hospital. He was in there for 2 days for a checkup. And as he was getting ready to walk out of the room, he had a massive heart attack and he died. He was only 69 years old. And the funeral procession from Tuscaloosa to Birmingham was 5 miles long. And I was in that procession myself, and I tell you, it was the largest funeral in the South. I'm sure Elvis was too, right in there. since President Roosevelt died, and of course that took place somewhat in Georgia. But Coach Bryant, he lived over in Monroe Bottoms, Arkansas. He was a seventh child, and he played in the first football game he ever saw. And when he heard the roar of the crowd, that changed his life. It changed his life. And he played in a football game one day against Tennessee with a broken leg. That's a famous story, and it's actually true. And his mother was the one who made the living for the family. She raised crops and produce and stuff, and his daddy was a sickly man. He played the organ in the Pentecostal church that Coach Bryant went to, and she would preach when the preacher couldn't get there on the cold, snowy days. But every year, though, he loved the Christian boys on the team, and he'd give one check a year to help pay for everything the Alabama FCA group needed. But in 2014, I wrote a book called 50 Years of Crimson Tide Faith. It's short stories about the great Christian football players we've had at Alabama in the last 50 years through FCA. And, of course, Barrett Jones, your Barrett Jones, wrote the foreword for me. And it goes from Steve Sloan and Paul Crane to Barrett Jones and C.J. Mosley. And he wrote the foreword for me. And, of course, the Jones family has made such a great contribution to Alabama. Of course, the family originally came from North Alabama. And I'd say we were talking today with Kim Wilson. And, you know, he's an Alabama graduate. I've known him about 30 years. But we were talking today, and probably no other college football player has ever had the career that Barrett Jones had. And as far as, here's a boy who never made less than an A, all A's, all the way through graduate school. He was All-American in 3 years at three different positions, right? Guard and left tackle and center on three national championship teams. I'm sure there's not another player in all the history of football that's ever had a career like that. Here's a Barrett right here. Jim, they named Barrett Jones after this Barrett, Barrett Sexton. And but I tell you what, I love Barrett, even though I wasn't there when he played, but I love his family. And on a side note, we had a Gene Stallings reunion last year in June, and Dabo Swinney was on our 92 team, and so he came. We'd only played that. We had just beaten them in that championship game, and there huddled up was Gene Stallings, Nick Saban, and Dabo Swinney talking, patting each other on the back, laughing, talking, you know, stuff. But I told Coach Saban something I always kind of wanted to tell him, especially lately, when they were trying to compare the two men, Bryant and Saban. I told him, I said, if Coach Bryant was living today, he would be your number one fan. He would love Nick Saban. But Billy Graham, well, let me tell you, I grew up with Billy Graham, watching him on television. And my daddy was evangelist. We loved him. But in 42 days, he'll be 99 years old. And when he reached his age of 98, you know what he wanted for his birthday meal? He wanted a can of Vienna sausages and a can of pork and beans. And that's what he had for his birthday meal. And in the later years here, he loves to eat sardines and crackers. Sonic is his favorite restaurant. And they go get him corn dogs and tater tots. That's what he loves to eat. And one of his favorite things is McDonald's hamburgers. And grandchildren come and he wants to grill hot dogs. And but it's been all right for him. You know, he's almost 98. He lives at home. He gets 24-hour-a-day nursing care. Has had that ever since his wife died 10 years ago. His mind's good. He's very frail and very weak. Can't see well enough to read the Bible. Have to read the Bible to him. Can't hear very well. Has a good appetite. Only sees family now. He prays a lot. You know, he always prayed in 1949. And we're praying for an old-fashioned Heaven sent Holy Ghost revival that will sweep our nation from coast to coast. And he's still praying that. And we still believe it's going to come. And but he sleeps a lot. And here's the thing. He travels six continents. And now he's down to two rooms. And we don't know why he's living. We have had a lot of people to figure it out. But in 1918, he was born along That same year was Paul Harvey, Oral Roberts, Sam Walton, Howard Cosell, Ted Williams, Betty Ford, Dear Abby. He's the only one still living. There's no way he should be living today. He's probably traveled more than most of all the great preachers and evangelists in the last 60 years put together, but he's still living. We know God has a plan. I love what David Jeremiah said not long ago, that God does not take a man until he has completed his work in him. And, of course, the first man I thought of was Billy Graham. He hadn't completed his work in him yet. But the grandchildren come, and they call him Daddy Bill. But for you young people, he grew up on a dairy farm right there in Charlotte, 4.5 miles outside of the downtown area now. They had 300 acres. They had 75 milk cows. He would milk 20 in the morning, 20 in the afternoon. Nothing famous whatsoever about the family at all. And when he was almost 16, he gave his life to Christ at a tent revival downtown. And he came home that night and he told his mother, "I've been saved tonight. My life will never be the same." And it wasn't. He never missed another service. And when he was 18 and 19 at Florida Bible Institute, God began to call him to preach. Now, when one Sunday, a little Baptist preacher said, "Billy," he knew he was going to be a preacher, "you're going to preach tonight at this little church." And Billy had 4 sermons, and he preached all 4 in 8 minutes. That's true. And he said, "I'll never be a preacher. I'll never be a preacher." However, from that first sermon, he went on to preach the gospel of Jesus Christ to more people than any man since the days of Christ. And estimated 215 million in a live audience, 2 billion with technology and all of that. And while attending the Bible college, he met a girl. And he loved this girl named Emily. And he just knew this was the girl. The mother broke him up because she said, "This boy won't amount to anything." And so here's what happened. In the last 60 years, he's been on the most admired list of people in the world. He's number 7 in the last 100 years of all people that ever lived on that list. I think she got it wrong, but, you know, he married a wonderful girl at Wheaton named Ruth, who had been a missionary's daughter in China. But he went on to preach the gospel, 419 crusades, preached in 185 countries. He counseled 13 presidents. He knew all the presidents from President Truman to Donald Trump. He knew 11 of them before they were president. And right now, I want to show you a video. Okay, Eric, it's your time, man. I want to show you about a 5-minute video on Mr. Graham, God's ambassador to the presidents. I think you'll be blessed by this.
If we were to follow the footsteps of an ordinary man who had one day been dramatically changed by an extraordinary God, would we believe those steps would journey from the rolling fields of North Carolina to the steps of the White House and beyond?
I just felt God was speaking to me, and he said, "I want to use you." And I said, "Lord, I'll go where you want me to go, and I'll be what you want me to be. I'm yours."
Christ belongs to all people. He belongs to the whole world. His gospel is for everyone, whoever you are.
He's one of the great evangelists of our nation's history. His crusades are legendary. The size of his crowds were magnificent throughout the years because of the message and because of the messenger.
That's the beauty and the greatness and the thrill of God's love.
The kind of person that a person in my position wants to know.
While preaching to millions around the world, Billy Graham found himself being called upon many times as God's ambassador to world leaders. The ministry of Billy Graham as friend and counselor to U.S. presidents remains to this day unprecedented. In 1950, Billy was asked to visit the White House for the first time to meet with then-President Harry S. Truman. Soon after, every U.S. president since World War II found occasion and reason to call on the advice and friendship of Billy Graham.
We need to pray for our president and for those in authority. As the scriptures have told us, he faces tremendous responsibilities
Lyndon Johnson wrote in a personal letter to Billy Graham, "My mind went back to those lonely occasions at the White House when your friendship helped to sustain a president in an hour of trial. No one will ever know how you helped to lighten my load or how much warmth you brought into our house. But I know."
The reason world leaders have sought his advice is precisely because he doesn't try to tell them what they should do tomorrow, but he does try to show them a way of thinking about the problem that adds a new dimension to their thinking.
Throughout the world, governmental leaders have been asking the tough spiritual questions of Billy Graham, looking for answers. His ministry as an evangelist, bringing the gospel of Jesus Christ, has worked to shape the destiny of nations.
At the end of these meetings with these communist officials, they would be sitting there in stone silence, listening to every word that my father said. And when my father finished speaking, they would say, "Oh, but Dr. Graham, we have also wondered if there was a God. Talk to us more about how we can know God."
So I think he was one of the forces that kept a window open to the human spirit during these oppressive years.
8 years ago, one of the Lord's great ambassadors, the Reverend Billy Graham, went to Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union, and upon returning spoke of a movement there toward more religious freedom. And perhaps he saw it before many of us, because it takes a man of God to sense the early movement of the hand of God.
And the same thing with these Chinese leaders that we saw in Russia. They would begin to ask my father spiritual questions. These are the kind of questions that were asked by top Chinese officials and Chinese leaders.
Reverend William Billy Graham's untiring evangelism has spread the word of God to every corner of the globe and made him one of the most inspirational spiritual leaders of the 20th century.
I think it's through him that I found myself praying even more than a daily basis to give me the wisdom to make decisions that would serve God and be pleasing to him.
Billy Graham, the man, the preacher, the humble farmer's son who helped change the world, is a spiritual gift to all of us.
Who is this unique person that comes across the pages of history? Who is this Jesus Christ?
He's had many opportunities over the years to do other things that he turned down because God had called him to a higher calling. And that was to be an ambassador of the Lord Jesus Christ and to take the gospel to literally the ends of the earth.
Yeah. Thank you. I'll tell you, he's the most humble man on earth, too. But one of my favorite stories, two favorite stories with presidents, and I've got many, is in 1968, President Johnson said, "Now, Billy, I'm not going to run for the second term. The Hunt Oil people in Dallas are going to give you all the money you need, and you're going to be president of the United States." And he could well have been. But Ruth, his wife, his wonderful wife, stepped up and said, "Well, Billy, why would you want to lower yourself to be president? Why would you want to lower yourself to be president when you have the greatest calling on earth?" And that's what we tell all the preachers who come to our place in the library. They got the greatest calling on earth. And in 1970, when President Nixon was going out in shame and disgrace and had to resign. Well, let me just say this first before I get to that story. In 1970, rather, he had a crusade. Some of you remember in Knoxville, Tennessee at the Tennessee Football Stadium. And he invited President Nixon to come as a guest. And came time for the offering. President doesn't carry money, so he borrows $5 from Billy. And so a few days later, here comes a letter and a $5 check from President Nixon to Billy. Now, they never cashed it. It's on display in our library. And the letter said, the first sentence says, "Dear Billy, a number of presidents have looked to you for spiritual substance through the years, and I'm sure I'm the first one to hit you up for a loan." But when Nixon was going out in shame and disgrace, he invited Billy Graham to come and spend the last night in the White House with him. And Ed Young, who's a great preacher out there in Houston, Second Baptist, he got word over to the Graham office that he didn't think that was a good idea. Now, he's telling the story in a sermon. And our evangelical leader shouldn't be associating himself with this man at this time. And he said, they sent me a note back that a shepherd does not leave his sheep in the dark. And he said, I learned a great lesson from that. And, of course, Billy went and spent the night with him. Billy Graham and Ruth and Franklin now were the best with fallen people. They always went to them. I could tell you story after story. He conducted 419 crusades, and he had 3.5 million people that came forward. And in the last 11 years in his retirement, through technology and internet evangelism, we've had 21 million souls for Christ. It's been 7 times stronger since he died than it was when he was preaching. And, of course, Franklin leads the way. In 44, Mr. Graham was a full-time evangelist for Youth for Christ. And he went to Los Angeles in 49 when he was 30. And that's when he became famous. They had 6,000 seats there. And it was right down the street, folks, from where Dragnet was, the police station. And Louis Zamperini came to know Christ of Unbroken. And Stuart Hamblin wrote a song. He became a Christian through that, and John Wayne suggested to him, that sounds like a good song, when he told him, you know, John, it's no secret what God can do. I was saved down there in that Billy Graham crusade. Sounds like a good song. And so he wrote it a month later in 19 minutes. But God used a maid to put Billy Graham on the map. He used the maid of William Randolph Hearst, because every morning she would go and serve him breakfast. He was the newspaper mogul at that time. And she would say, oh, Mr. Hearst, downtown is a young flaming evangelist from North Carolina, and he's drawing thousands down there. Next morning, oh, Mr. Hearst, this man is preaching the gospel of Jesus Christ, and people are coming by the thousands. It was the same thing for about 5 or 6 mornings. And finally, he called his editors, and he said, Puff Graham. And his name and pictures began to be across America on the front page, and God used a maid to put Billy Graham on the map. It sounds like an Old Testament story, but it's a true story. And you know, the two men never met. Billy Graham and William Randolph Hearst never met. Mr. Graham came to Memphis in 1951. He was 32 years old. It was his 19th crusade. He would go on to do 400 more. And they had it at the fairgrounds. And it lasted 4 weeks, if you can believe that, 1951. And he came back in 1978 and had it at the Liberty Bowl. Two of the guests were Johnny Cash and Andre Crouch. But throughout his travels, this is a local story here, Mr. Graham always loved hotels. It was a good thing he did. And early on in the 50s, he got to know Mr. Kimmons Wilson, who started, you know, Holiday Inn. And they became good friends. And after they became, Mr. Graham loved Holiday Inns because you could just pull your car right up to the door and take your things in. You come out, go jog and walk and just relax. He loved Holiday Inns. And Mr. Wilson one day gave him a lifetime free card pass to go to any Holiday Inn for free. And Kim, his son in town here, told me a few months ago it was the only one he ever gave to anybody, not even any of the presidents. A few years later, Mr. Graham met Conrad Hilton. And Conrad Hilton gave him a free pass to all the hotels anywhere in the world. And then a few years later, he met J.W. Marriott, and he gave him a free pass. And the others didn't even know. And that's a true story. But whenever Mr. Graham went to a hotel with a doorman, a bellman, or just a person that took his luggage, or the maid, or the person who gave him room service, hi, I'm Billy Graham. What's your name? How long have you worked here? Tell me about your family. Where do you go to church? He did that with all of them. He'd do that when he'd go to the stadium and the guy parking the cars and the guy who was the event staff and the guy running around on stage up here. Hi, I'm Billy Graham. That was Billy Graham. And And so, one other thing he would do when he would meet people, he would ask this question: are all of your family members saved? Are all of them saved? And when I had a little talk with him, when I came 11 years ago, I knew that, you know, I knew he did that, but I went ahead and told him about my family before he asked me about my daddy. But Coach Bowden, he spoke at 2 Billy Graham Crusades, and in 1972, Billy Graham had a crusade in Birmingham, Alabama at Legion Field. And on stage stood Billy Graham, Tom Landry, who was there to give a testimony, Joe Namath, who was there working out with the Jets, Coach and Mrs. Paul Bear Bryant. Coach Bryant and Billy Graham were good friends. And here's what happened. Let me go back 5 years ago. When I was at graduate school, I lived in Paul Bryant Hall, and I lived three doors down the hall when Joe was a senior. And I'd go by his room every day at noon to pick up all his mail and answer it for him, all his fan mail. And I'd always, he's a good Roman Catholic, and I'd always say, Joe, you going to Mass tomorrow? Oh, yeah. He was very faithful. And I always felt spiritually accountable to Joe. And here's what happened. At that funeral, I was asked, we had a funeral in Tuscaloosa of an old coach named Dude Hennessy. He'd been there all 20-something years. And here's what happened. The family asked me to read the Old Testament scripture in the Roman Catholic Mass, and I was thrilled. And I'd been with Dude all those years. And then I got a note about who the speakers were after the Mass ended. It was to be Mal Moore, A.D., Ray Perkins, and Joe Namath. Well, I hadn't seen Joe in a while. So there we were, sitting on the second row. And afterwards, I got to tell Joe that I work for Billy Graham now. So I went up to Joe. I said, well, Joe, I work for Billy Graham now. You, too. It was just like that. You know, I was surprised me with his response. And he began to tell me all about that 1972 crusade. And I knew all about it. So I wanted to see what he said. Would you like to have a picture? Oh, yeah. So I said, and then he got right up in my face and he said, now I want to tell you something. He knows me as a Christian, FCA and everything. He said, several years later, I ran into Billy Graham in an airport, and we had a long talk, and that day he reaffirmed my faith in Jesus Christ. Well, I was so thrilled that I could, you know, God just knew I needed to hear that, and it was just the glorious thing. But I want to show one more little short film clip, and this is about the Billy Graham Library. It lasts 2 minutes, and then we're going to close out here. So I want you to know that the Billy Graham Library has been open 10 years. We've had 1.1 million people from 95 countries. It's 14 huge galleries with the best technology to tell his story. And we've had 29,000 decisions for Christ at the end of the tour. That's why we're there.
You're invited on a journey. A journey of inspiration. A journey of discovery. The Billy Graham Library is a library like no other. It's more than just a walk through history. It's a journey through the legacy of a simple life that impacted millions worldwide.
Mr. Khrushchev says that history is on his side. Mr. Kennedy says history is on his side. I want to say tonight, history is on the side of Christ.
Admission is free, so come retrace Billy Graham's path from humble farm boy to international ambassador of God's love through multimedia, photos, and memorabilia.
And we're praying that in these days we might see an old fashioned. We're praying that in these days we might see an old fashioned.
But the fruit of the Spirit is love. I'm announcing good news.
Tour the restored Graham family home place for an intimate look at Billy's roots. Relax in the stillness of the library grounds. Browse the Ruth's Attic bookstore and have a fresh meal or treat at the Graham Brothers Dairy Bar. Enjoy special exhibits, events, and seasonal activities for the whole family.
The moment I walk into the grounds, you just feel that peace and joy.
I don't think I've ever teared up or got chills so many times walking through any type of museum or library.
I just didn't realize the magnitude of Reverend Graham's ministry.
It is so angelic. I just feel like it's heaven on earth.
I do not believe
any of us are here by chance. God has brought each of us here for a purpose.
What drew crowds by the millions to hear Billy's message? How was he a friend and counselor to so many world leaders? What drove him to speak boldly in times of unrest and uncertainty? Find out on this free Journey of Discovery at the Billy Graham Library.
Let me know when you're coming and I'll give you the grand tour. And I close with this story. For several seasons at Alabama when I was there, on Friday night before a game, where we went home or staying in a Paul Bryant Conference Center hotel at home, I'd get the whoever is voluntary, but we'd have a devotion and prayer. We always had chapel, but for the whole team. But I'd get the boys together after their snack time around 9:45, and we would have a short scripture and prayer. And we'd have 20, 25 boys, players, together in one of the boys' rooms. And so on this one particular night at Vanderbilt in Nashville in 1999, I asked Chris Samuels, our big left tackle, who was number 3 draft choice, to read the scripture and say something. Now, I had never heard him say anything spiritual. His daddy was a Baptist preacher down in Mobile. And he said he would. And I was delighted. And so he read his scripture. And then this is what he said. He said, "You know, guys, every Thursday they post on the locker room door address list. And you know, some of us don't have to look at that list because we know our name's already on that list." And he said, "But some of the guys have to go by there and just check and hope that their name is on that list. And some are not, some make it and some don't." And he said, "The point is this," as he was talking to the boys in that room that night, "when we know God and his son Jesus Christ, we have him in our heart. And we know that when we die, we're on God's dress list. We know we're going to heaven. What we have to be concerned about is that we make sure that our teammates are on God's dress list. If they're not, we need to help them know how to get on the list. And that's all I got to say." Well, I was standing there, and I thought, I've just heard one of the most profound examples of the gospel I've ever heard from a guy I'd never heard say anything. And I stood there, and of course, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in him should not perish, but have everlasting life. And you know, today is the day of salvation. And if you're here tonight, and you're not sure that your sins have been forgiven, and you're not sure that you have ever invited Jesus Christ to really be your Lord and Savior, I want you to know that there's a mansion in heaven waiting you to accept or reject. There's a mansion waiting you to accept or reject. Don't let pride, stubbornness, let someone who is a hypocrite send you to hell, to eternal punishment, everlasting punishment, torment, loneliness, misery, with no relief. So which do you choose? The mansion in heaven? Or do you choose eternal torment? You have to be sure that your name's on that God's dress list. And you know, we do have so many signs today. Some of us believe that we don't have much time left on this earth. Time is short. We see so many end time signs today like never before. In Luke, the 21st chapter and the 25th verse, it says, "And Jesus said, in the end times there will be signs in the sun, moon, and stars. There will be terror among the nations, and there will be roaring seas, and there will be strange tides," T-I-D-E-S. That's Luke 21 and 25. The eclipse was one of the greatest end time signs we've ever seen in our lifetime, and most Christians missed it. And let me tell you, Luke 21, 25, the eclipse came on August 21, and Hurricane Irma followed on August 25th. Luke 21, 25. And then this past Saturday, those who've studied Bible prophecy for decades have been looking for September 23, 2017. When you read in Revelation 12, 1 through 3, about the woman who's going to give birth to a baby, it says, and you, on a graph we have, you lay out a woman on her back, And it says in Revelation 12, 1 and 2, there are 12 stars at her head. The sun is at her head. The moon's at her feet. And Mercury. And one of the other stars is a stomach, which represents the gestation and the birth to become. All of that took place for the first time in the astrologers tell us last Saturday. And here's the thing. That baby represents what many believe is that Jesus Christ is going to come back. And at the same time last weekend, we had Hurricane Jose and Hurricane Maria coming. And the meaning of those names are Joseph and Mary. Joseph and Mary, who gave birth to the Christ child. So it can't get any more clearer today that God is in serious business. And I mean, you could go on and on and on. You know, there are hurricanes all over the world today. We got the floods, the earthquakes. We got Montana that's dry as a bone and praying for rain. And we've got all of these disasters, which is elevating all the time. So it just tells us. And we're living in the last of the last days. I truly believe that. And so I want you to all bow your heads in prayer.